lovely to be here with you this morning. It's really a delight to preach in a sanctuary with such beautiful windows. And I have to congratulate you, or at least the ghosts who inhabit this hall, for not giving in to the spirit of New England iconoclasm. There's something to be said for opulent beauty. It's also a privilege to share Theodore Parker's old pulpit. I imagine that almost every other guest minister you've had has made the same observation. I greatly admire Parker's commitment to abolitionism and his transcendentalist movement away from liberal Christianity. He sought to put ethics at the center of our religious tradition. He taught that it is more important what we do than what we believe. When I graduated from seminary, I received my diploma across his old writing desk, the one he used to keep a gun in so that he could defend the fugitive slaves he and his congregation sheltered. Learned a lot from my study of Parker. He was actually a deeply flawed person like the rest of us. Despite being an abolitionist, he was a racist. And Parker's racism serves as a reminder that even the greatest amongst us have our faults. I'd also like to say it's a privilege to share the pulpit with David Park this morning. David's own work as a scholar minister and as a justice activist has inspired me. My decision to leave the parish and pursue my doctorate is partially in response to a warning he gave some decades ago. Unless more young people embrace theology as a vocation, Unitarian Universalism is in danger of losing its distinctive religious mission and ending up a network of secular temples. Now, the sermon I offer you this morning is an adaptation of one that I preached last summer while I was serving as the July minister for First Parish Milton. During my time there, I gave a month-long sermon series on Unitarian Universalism as religion of presence. Each week was organized around a different question. The fourth and final week, I asked, what does it mean to be present to the holy? And it's this final question with which we will wrestle today. Now, the question could be recast, where do we find God? God, of course, is one of the most difficult words to define. I was reminded of this difficulty several months ago while having dinner with friends. They have a 4-year-old who's just at the point of asking big questions. Recently, she was asking them about God. Now, my friends are not the sort of people who believe in a God that sits outside of the universe, outside of human history, judging all of us. They believe in what a theologian might call an immanent God, a God that is part of the universe, who makes up everything and us. So when their daughter asked them about God, they told her that God lived inside her. A horrified look came over her face. No, she replied. There's nothing inside of me. It's just me. This story suggests the challenge we face when communicating about the holy. Language frequently fails us. It's difficult to talk about the holy because people can't even agree about what they're talking about. Words are but gestures to a larger reality. They frame how we understand the world, but they are not the world. A few years ago, the physicist Stephen Hawking generated significant interest by claiming that the findings of modern science had demonstrated that God was no longer necessary. We have a fairly complete picture of how the universe works, how it came into being, how life evolves. With all of this knowledge, he reasoned, there's no longer room for God in the rational mind. Liberal theologians have long argued the opposite. God, they claim, is not a rational construct. God is a feeling. Friedrich Schleiermacher, sometimes described as the father of liberal theology, believed that the feeling of absolute dependence is the experience of consciousness of God. It is in the moments that I am most aware of my dependence that I feel the presence of the holy. I close my eyes and it fills my senses. The room, dark, pitch even, illuminated only by the haze of medical machines and a blue string of Christmas lights. Hysteria, desperation, The sounds of panic and despair contrast the dimness of the room. On the bed, the thin, wan, retreating figure of a 16-year-old girl. Her Haitian mother wails, alternating between Creole and English, over her faded body. The words come back, a terrible litany of loss. There will be no graduation for you. There will be no wedding for you. There will be no babies for you. There will be nothing for you. Nothing. For the last 5 months, the daughter has struggled with cancer. Tonight, she has lost that struggle. The doctors and the nurses have told her parents it is over. Everything but the morphine drip has been disconnected. This is it. The daughter is about to die, is dying, is dead. Over the decade that I have spent as a member of the clergy, I have witnessed many deaths and conducted many funerals. This one, this death of a young immigrant to cancer, remains one of the most poignant. Perhaps because the mother's wails echoed the famous words from the 22nd Psalm, words repeated by Jesus as he died on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Or maybe it's because at that moment I felt an intense connection to life itself. The waning breaths of the young woman, the mother's love, the prayers we said together combined, and I knew that I was in the presence of something greater than myself. For to be witness to death is to be witness to our absolute dependence. Despite this, it is at death and at moments of pain that the absence of the holy can be felt most profoundly. William Scholes, past president of the Unitarian Universalist Association and former director of Amnesty International, once gave a lecture entitled, What Torture Has Taught Me. In it, he challenged the concept of an immanent God, a God present in all things, by claiming that no God worthy of the name is present in a torture chamber. Rabbi Irving Greenberg offered a counter perspective when trying to make sense of the Holocaust. To the question, where was God at Auschwitz? The answer is, God was there, starving, broken, humiliated, gassed and burned alive, sharing the infinite pain as only an infinite capacity for pain can share it. African-American theologians like Kelly Brown Douglas make a similar point when they argue for the necessity of a black Christ. In this view, Christ needs to be black so that he can accompany, in Brown's words, the black struggle to make do and do better in the face of racist, sexist, classist, and heterosexist oppression. As Brown puts it, Christ is inside my grandmother and other black women and men as they fight for life and wholeness. Now, I don't pretend to know whether William Scholes or Greenberg and Douglas are right. What I do know, though, is that one of the most political decisions each of us makes, that each culture makes, is how we define the holy. Rebecca Parker makes precisely this point when talking about the crucifixion of Jesus. She writes, to say that Jesus' executioners did what was historically necessary for salvation is to say that state terrorism is a good thing, that torture and murder are the will of God. To choose between locating the holy in Jesus' life or in his death is to choose between two radically different theologies. The option of finding it in both or in neither or in all things are other options. When we start to think about the holy, we are confronted with questions beyond just the choice to find it in life or in death. We must also ask, does the holy only belong to some people? Is it found only in some places? Is it everywhere and everything? Is it but a metaphor? Is it separate from the visible world? Does it act upon us? Do we act upon it? How do we know when we experience its presence? These are not questions with rational answers. They are tied to feelings. I do not know how I know. I only know when I feel. I was 14. It was my first time away from my parents for an extended period. I was at a week-long Unitarian Universalist youth camp up in the Pacific Northwest. The grounds abutting the ocean were rich with immense trees. The camp was isolated and powered by its own generators. Each night and after dinner and the evening worship, there was a hymn sing around a campfire. The last night of camp, we had a dance. It was a wonderfully goofy affair. People dressed in ridiculous costumes, painted their faces, and flailed around to punk anthems by The Clash or disco jams like the YMCA by the Village People. After an hour, or maybe two, the power suddenly went out. The dance's abrupt end found a number of us back at the fire pit, singing. It was the only place on the campground with any light, and besides, we enjoyed making music together. I don't know how long we sang, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and an hour. It was a consuming experience. Eventually, we reached the hymn, "Over My Head." You might remember the first verse. "Over my head, I hear music in the air. Over my head, I hear music in the air. Over my head, I hear music in the air. There must be a God somewhere." We sang that song for a while, substituting new phrases for what was over our heads as we went on. Laughter, joy, singing. Someone, a little snidely, finally suggested light. And when we reached the end of the "there must be a God somewhere," the power at the camp came back on. It seemed like a minor miracle. It might have been someone's idea of a prank. Whatever the explanation, the experience left an impression. Up until that moment in my youthful wisdom, I would have described myself as an atheist. After that, I wasn't so sure. I was more open to the mystery of our lives and cognizant of the limitations of language. I understand that words like the holy, the divine, and God are but metaphors for our experience of connection to something greater than ourselves. The human mind, marvelous as it is quite small, and each of us in the end can grasp but an infinitesimal fraction of the universe's complexity. To speak of the holy, I believe, is to acknowledge this. There is a certain timelessness to my memories of the holy. They fade far less than others do. They come forward in vivid color rather than tatted gray, occasionally so strong that they blot out the present. There is a difference between holy time and ordinary time. The experience of the holy is more defined, placed in sharper relief. It marks me, changes me, even if the change is ever so slight. James Wright's poem, A Blessing, speaks to this. In his poem, Wright finds himself in a perfectly ordinary place, just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, observing the ordinary. For what is more ordinary in rural Minnesota than two ponies munching young tufts of spring in the darkness? And yet, it is here that Wright finds a blessing. Simply observing these ordinary ponies, the affection they have for each other, and the peace they seem to feel while grazing alone, together, makes him realize that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom. Wright's poem suggests that the transformative experience, being in the presence of the holy, can be found in even the most unremarkable of activities. It is not what surrounds us that matters. We do not need to seek out the extraordinary to find the holy. There are many stories from the Bible that are instructive of this dynamic. One found in the book of Genesis is the story of Jacob wrestling with what the text refers to as a divine being. In the story, Jacob, the patriarch whose children eventually founded the tribes of Israel, stops alone by the side of a river to spend the night. It's there that he finds a man, and they wrestle all night, the man trying to escape Jacob, Jacob refusing to let him go. Finally, the dawn comes. The man wrenches Jacob hips from his socket and says to him, "Let me go, for dawn is breaking." Jacob replies, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And so the divine being blesses Jacob. In doing so, he changes his name. To me, this story instructively suggests several things. The holy can be found anywhere. Jacob encountered it on a riverbank. James Wright discovered it in two ponies. I have felt its presence in the room of a dying child and at a youth camp. When we find it, we must somehow engage it. It must be wrestled with. Wright looked at the ponies. Jacob struggled against the divine being. To be in the presence of the holy is to be open to change. Jacob received a blessing and a new name. Wright wanted to burst from his body. This change can come at a cost, a limp, pain, the presence of death, but it does not have to. One suspects that the only thing Wright's experience of ponies like wet swans cost him was reflection. The story of Jacob and the feeling of being present to the holy is helpful on another level, a moral level. It reminds us that the experience of the holy requires the experience of another. Each of the experiences that I have described is an experience of connection, not an experience of an autonomous, isolated individual. We each construct our theologies out of our personal experiences, and since each of our experiences are different, our theologies can be different as well. But this might seem like it would lead to moral relativism, but it does not have to. For if being in the presence of the holy means being present to our feelings of dependence and connection, then we know we have strayed when we disavow those feelings. Moral clarity comes from understanding our dependence on the universe and not claiming some sort of independence from it. For me, there's really only one heresy worth interrogating, the myth of the autonomous individual. None of the experiences of the holy that I have described have taken place in a vacuum. All of them are interactions between people or between people and the larger world. We need each other, or at least an other, to experience the holy. It's like that hymn we sang that night at youth camp. Over my head, there is singing in the air. Over our heads, there is always something in the air. And it is through that something, because of that something, and with that something, that we know we are in the presence of the holy. Blessed be. And amen.